ॐ सदाशिवसमारम्भाम् शङ्कराचार्यमध्यमाम् अस्मदाचार्यपर्यन्ताम् वन्दे गुरुपरम्पराम्। ॐ सहनावतु, सहनौ भुनक्तु, सह वीर्यम् करवावहै, तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। If we can, let's chant the first two verses together. I sent out a copy that had a little more readable transliteration and a translation. Prata smarana stotram. Pratasmarami hridi samspuradatma tattvam Sachit sukham paramahamsa gatim turiyam Yat svapna jagara sushuptam avaiti nityam Tad brahma nishtam At dawn, I contemplate upon truth, which is the self shining in the heart. Pure being, consciousness, limitless fullness, the abode of wise renunciates. That fourth, which ever perceives the three states of dreaming, waking, and deep sleep. I am that Brahman, undivided, not a collection of elements. Om Pratarbhajami Manaso Vachasamagamyam Vacho vibhanti nikhilaya danugrahena Yanneti neti vachanair nigama avochan Tandeva deva majamachutamahuragriyam. At dawn, I revel in that self which is unreachable, not objectifiable by words or the mind, by whose grace, awareness, existence, all words shine, reveal their meaning. The self, which the Vedic teaching tradition reveals by the words, not this, not this, negating all falsely limiting superimpositions. That self, the wise say, is the God of gods, the one who illumines all luminaries, unborn, imperishable, the cause of all. This is what we've seen so far. So repeat after me. Pratarnamami tamasah Pratarnamami tamasah Again, we'll repeat twice after me. Pratarnamami tamasah Good. Param arkavarnam Param arkavarnam Param arkavarnam. So just so you know, there is no such word as tamasaf. There is no F sound in Sanskrit. It sounds very bad to my ears because when you put the words together, tamasaf param, then that's when the F sound comes, tamasaf param, because it's followed by a pakara of param. But just by itself, it's very jarring to hear. But I broke it up because that's when you chant it, you'll say tamasaf param, as if that visarga, the H with a dot underneath it, is as if there's an F sound. It's actually called the upadmaniya, and it's a common change under certain circumstances. Let's do the first line again together. Pratarnamami tamasaf paramarkavarnam. Listen. Purnam sanatana padam. Twice. Purnam sanatana padam. Purnam sanatana padam. Listen. Purushottamakhyam. Now I broke up the Purusha Uttama Akhya. So I broke the sandhi there. There's no better way to do it. Otherwise, it all blurs together. And if you're looking at the transliteration, it's harder to understand. But the Purushottamakhyam is how it's pronounced. Purushottamakhyam. So repeat. Purushottamakhyam. 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 Listen. Yasmin nidan jagat. Repeat. Yasmin nidan jagat. Yasmin nidan jagat. Ashesham ashesham urtao. Ashesham ashesham urtao. Ashesham ashesham urtao. Radvam bhujangama iva. Radvam bhujangama iva. Radvam bhujangama iva. Pratibhasitam vai. Pratibhasitam vai. Pratibhasitam vai. Let's do the whole thing slowly together. Pratarnamami tamasaf paramarkavarnam. Purnam sanatana padam purushottamakhyam. Yasmin nidan jagat ashesham ashesham urtao. Radvam bhujangama iva pratibhasitam vai. This is the last verse of this hymn. There is one last verse. And that's what's called a palashruti, and it is actually an addendum to the verse itself. So this is actually the last verse of the three-verse stotra. And the words here are pratar, in the morning, namami, tamasaha, param, arkavarnam, purnam, sanatana padam, purusha uttama akhyam, yasmin, and there's a double nakara there because of sandhi, the way the words come together. So that's why I put one in parentheses there, but you actually pronounce it. Yasmin nidan jagat. Yasmin idam jagat ashesham. Ashesham murtau. Radjwam bhujangamaha iva pratibhasitam vai. Pratar, at dawn, namami. Namami means I salute, I bow down to. There's a tatu nam, which means to bow down to or salute. Namaskaraha, namaste, namahate, namastubhyam. To you, my namaskaras, my salutations. But in the West, we think of a salute as something that they do in the army. It can also mean some gesture of respect, like this. Or actually touching someone's feet, bowing down, doing namaskaram. It's a gesture of surrender. When it's done to the Lord or something sacred, it's a gesture of surrender. How do we surrender, and what are we surrendering to? We're actually surrendering to Atmatattvam, which is back up in the first verse. Atmatattvam, the tattva, the truth which is the self, which is I, which is me. How do I surrender to I? How do I surrender to myself? Hands up, surrender. Through knowledge. I surrender in knowledge, in the recognition of the true nature of who I am. See, we're lacking no experience of who we are. We're lacking no experience of the self. We're just lacking what is called vishesha jnanam. We are present in every single experience. So when I know something, when I see the pot, what needs to happen? I need to gain an experience of the pot and then cognize it as a pot. It seems as if there's one fluid thing going on here, but really if we break it down, I have a means of knowledge, the eyes. Light from the lamp is reflected on the pot. The light comes into the eyeballs. The eyeballs trigger some neurological magic, which causes a form of vritti, a chitta vritti, a thought form, which is congruent with the shape and color of this pot. The pot is as though loaded in my working memory, in my mind. It actually takes the form of that. And then consciousness illumines that thought form, and that thought is known. I know that this is a pot. If I wasn't there to illumine the thought, there would be no cognition. It's like a slide projector. I don't know if there people have any slide projectors anymore. It's like an iPhone screen. We load the JPEG into working memory, but if the light is not on, the phone can be on, but the light of the screen may not be on. And still, you can say that the JPEG is still there, the image is still there, but without the light, it doesn't come to light. So the first thing is to load the image, load the PNG or the JPEG or the TIFF or whatever, for a RAW file, whatever you're using, and then a light comes and illumines it. And that's the example we use in this year. We used to use slide projectors, but who knows what a slide projector is anymore. Right? You load the slide into the carousel, and it comes into position, and it loads, and then it's illumined, and you see what's there. Now, that's how most knowledge happens. We don't need to do the first step for the Atma, because I am the illuminator of all thoughts. Consciousness is the illuminator of all thoughts. I don't need to load the Atma in my experience, because there is no experience without the Atma. Atma as chit, which is sat, which is not changing, which is ever present, illumines all of the changing experience, like we addressed a little bit in today's meditation. All experiences have two parts. Experience has the changing part and the non-changing part. The non-changing part is the illuminating presence, which I bring to all experiences. The problem is that we take ourselves to be these changing aspects of our experience. I experience the body. If I need to know the body, how do I know it? I load it in through the senses. My input mechanisms into the brain are the five senses. Only way I know this body is through the five senses. And so if I experience this body, I feel it, I can hear it, and therefore this body comes to light. So too, the feelings, the thoughts, the emotions, our activity, our potential, our lack of potential, our ignorance, our knowledge, all of that is known to me. Now, the thing is that why are we studying then? If I don't need a new experience, if I don't need to experience the self, then what are we talking about here? If I already have knowledge of the self, there is no lack of experience of the self, then why are we studying these texts? Why are we listening? What is it that we're seeking? We have what's called samanya jnanam. Samanya means a general knowledge. We lack vishesha jnanam. We lack specific knowledge. Because what occurs is what's called anyonya adhyasa. Anya, anya, adhyasa. Adhyasa means a superimposition. Anya, anya means mutual, a mutual superimposition wherein I take myself to be the particularities of this jiva. I take myself to be this body, mind, sense, the whole history, my inclinations, my good attributes, my bad attributes, however I judge those. I take myself to be all these things. And in reality, all of these things come to light because of the me, because of the presence of consciousness, which is I. When we peel away all these things, there's no way that I can be what it is that I perceive from this perspective. So I have a subject-object relationship with the thoughts in my mind. Why do I judge myself to be angry when there's anger in my heart and the anger in my mind? Why do I take myself to be stupid when I say something stupid? So consciousness is mistaken for these ever-changing attributes of these upadhis, the karya, karana, sangata, the apparently limiting adjuncts, which are the body-mind-sense complex. I said it in Sanskrit, then I said it in English. I hope the English makes a little more sense. The karya, karana, sangata is this collection, this aggregate of body and mind and senses. And it's technically called upadhi because if you remember from Tattva Bodha class, an upadhi is something whose mere proximity apparently lends its attribute to something else. And the example we use, of course, is the crystal. Upadhi is the orange cloth, which thereby makes the clear crystal orange. This is the upadhi. Here we have adhyasa. We have this superimposition of orange on the crystal. And therefore, if I didn't know better, if I did not have what's called viveka jnanam, discriminative knowledge, I would think, foolishly, that the crystal is orange. But it's not. It's clear. But even with the presence of the orange behind the crystal, I can still know that the crystal is not orange. So, too, I take this body to be conscious and existent, and I take myself to be the body and the mind. So a famous example that's used is a red-hot iron ball. If I have a red-hot iron ball, I can say, the iron ball burnt me. The iron ball burnt me. I touched the iron ball and it burnt me, which is completely erroneous because there's actually two things in a red-hot iron ball. What's in a red-hot iron ball is the heavy, round iron and the hot red fire. So when I say the iron burnt me, it's not true at all. The fire burnt me. And in my cognitive process, in my knowledge, I can appreciate that the hot red fire is different than the round heavy iron ball. And that's viveka. If I have discriminative knowledge, I can separate the two out, even when there is that apparent anyonya adhyasa, the superimposition wherein I take iron to be red and hot, and I take fire to be round and heavy. So too, I take this body to be me. The body, mind, sense complex is superimposed due to my ignorance of the nature of myself upon pure existent conscious Atma. And the body seems to enjoy an innate existence and awareness. But any existence, any awareness that the mind or the body seem to enjoy is merely borrowed from the Shuddhatma, from the pure self. Any orangeness that the crystal seems to enjoy is merely borrowed and is non-essential, is incidental. What's fundamental is the purity of the spatika of the crystal. So here we say that this pratar namami tamasah paramarka varnam. We say that it is tamasah param, it is beyond darkness, it transcends darkness, and is arkavarnam. Arkavarnam. And I am surrendering to this knowledge. So in this knowledge, based on this discriminative understanding of the nature of the self, I can clearly see the truth of my being. And that truth of the being is likened to the color of the sun and is beyond darkness. Now, you may know the word tamas from rajas and sattva and tamas, one of the three gunas. But it also just means darkness. Like at the end of the class, one of the chants we do is asatoma sadgamaya, tamasoma jyotirgamaya, mrityurma amritangamaya. Tamasoma jyotihi gamaya, gamaya, lot, second person imperative, niche, causative. Make me go, lead me, gamaya, lead ma, mom, lead me, tamasaha, 5-1, from darkness, jyotihi, 2-1, to light. Lead me from darkness to light. What does that mean? It means lead me from ignorance to knowledge. Because light removes darkness. And so light is often used as a drishtanta for knowledge, because you have the flashlight, the torch of knowledge, you're shining in a dark place and you see what's there. So knowledge is antithetical to ignorance, and knowledge removes ignorance. Here, consciousness is seen to be like the sun. Varna means color, arka means sun. The color of the sun, the splendor of the sun, the brilliance of the sun. It's as though the self is shining like the sun. Why do we use the sun as an example of consciousness? Because the sun lights up everything, illumines everything, and it's not touched by anything. And it lights up without being a karta, without being a doer. So when we say the sun illumines, the sun is not busy being an illuminator. By nature, the sun shines. The sun is brilliant. And it just so happens that things get in the way of the sun, reflect the light, and then we see them. The sun isn't doing something to illumine. Consciousness, awareness, is not an awarer. To back ourselves into appreciation of this most subtle self, we put ourselves into a position wherein we see that I am the awarer of the awared. I am the one who is aware of the things one is able to be aware of. How do we become aware of something? Through means of knowledge, through our senses. And I'm aware of the mind because I have a subject-object relationship with it. And so we say, oh, well, consciousness, Atma, must be the awarer, must be the Sakshi. But even that is provisional. That's like saying the sun is the shiner. And the sun is busy shining, and that's his job. He is the karta. He is the prakashana karta. He is the one who shines. No, the nature of the sun is just to shine. That's just the nature of it. The nature of the self is just to shine as awareness. And when put in juxtaposition of something to be aware of, then that Atma seems to assume the role of a subject, which is a doer of being aware of something. There's a subject-object split. I am the awarer of the awared thing, the thing that I'm aware of. But you can't shoehorn consciousness into that role of the Sakshi. And yet from the perspective of being the witness, the Sakshi, from that point I can resolve that awareness. I free myself from all these incidental attributes. And then I need to turn around and recognize the nature of the wearer as being just awareness. And so the example that's given here is the brilliance of the sun. And the sun, even though it might appear reflected in all these media, let's say we have three different pots. Just imagine. Use your imagination. Three different pots. And they're filled with water. And one of them is filled with muddy, dirty water. One of them is shaking. The wind is rippling the surface of the water, and it's just agitated. It's like the ocean has been the last few days, just utterly agitated. And the other one is quiet. The other pot has water, which is very placid, very quiet, very calm. Now the sun is reflected in each of these three pots. And one pot can say, that the sun is very muddy and dirty. It's almost opaque. This pot is filled with tamoguna. Very dull-minded. Oh, I can't concentrate. I can't do anything. I'm still a conscious being, but I'm just overwhelmed by my sleepiness. The other pot, the middle pot, which it has agitated water, which still reflects that same sun, that pot water is going to be saying, I'm so agitated. I'm so angry. I'm so desirous. I shouldn't have had that 12th cup of coffee today. Why did my boss talk to me that way? Why is this person doing this? Why is that? That's a rajoguna pradhana water. That's the water which is filled with this rajas, which is agitation. You know, it's sort of like a Goldilocks story. This bed is too soft. This bed is too hard. This bed is just right. And the third pot of water is the calm bucket of water, the calm pot of water. And it's saying, ah, goodness, I'm just so happy. I'm I'm sitting here, I'm watching the sunset, the sky is beautiful, there's no demands on me, I'm warm, I have beauty around me, my mind is quiet, my mind is calm, I am calm. That same sun is reflected in each of these three small bodies of water in the pot. And in each of them, we take the nature of the sun to be modified by the obtaining condition of the water, be it muddy, agitated, or calm. Technically called the chit abhasa, the reflection, literally the reflection of consciousness in the mind, is taken to enjoy and be colored by the conditions of the mind. So I take myself to be dull. I take myself to be agitated, desirous. I take myself to be calm. None of them are truly the nature of the sun. The sun just shines, regardless of what the state of the water is. Now, in a calm mind, in the calm water, the sun is more perfectly reflected. In a calm mind, it's the calm water that can appreciate the true nature of the sun that's reflected in it. All examples have their parameters, so don't get too hung up in this reflection model, because then we'll bring in another model that will dismiss this model. But just see what we're trying to say. The sun is taken to be constrained by and enjoy the qualities of a reflective medium. Consciousness is taken to have the qualities of the obtaining condition of this mind and of this heart. And that is a dhyasa, that is superimposition. And it gives a very beautiful example going forward here. So the sun is self-luminous, meaning it's self-evident. It doesn't need a second thing to reveal it. It makes no sense to put a flashlight to try to see the sun. The sun is self-evident. Now, this is not a proof, but an example to point your mind towards the self-evident consciousness. Consciousness is always blowing forth. It's always brilliantly shining. It's always, always in waking, in dream, and even in deep sleep. But the thing is, in deep sleep, the jiva is avyakta. The individuality is resolved into just the karana sharira, and just the causal body. There is no manifestation of a knower in deep sleep. And yet awareness is there, because when I come out of deep sleep, I can talk about it. Oh, I slept really well, and I look forward to it. Oh, we look forward to sleep. So in every experience, any changing aspect of our experience is just incidental. Just like the agitated light reflecting off an agitated body of water. So we have this general knowledge of ourselves, but we don't have the specific knowledge of ourselves. The experience of consciousness, which is existent, is always present. But first of all, I mistake the truth of me to be subject to the vicissitudes of the things I take myself to be. What I need to do is gain the particular knowledge of the self, the specific knowledge of the self. I don't need to gain a new experience, but I need to understand the nature of this experience. The example that's given at the end of this verse is one of snake and rope. Let's say you're walking down a dark alley and you see a snake. The truth is that there's a rope, but there's an adhyasa. There's a superimposition of the snake upon the rope. And the form of the snake is the form of the rope. Let's say the rope looks like an S. The snake will look like an S. Let's say that the surface of the rope is rough. The snake will have a rough surface. Let's say that the rope is 2 feet long. The snake will be 2 feet long. Right? And so that which is superimposed enjoys the qualities of that upon which it is superimposed. The mind and body seem to be existent and seem to be awareful. But in truth, it's not. How do I gain the knowledge of the rope? When I see the snake, I have a general knowledge that there's something there. Just like now, I have to, do you exist? Yes, I exist. Are you conscious? Yes, I'm conscious. Are you happy? Well, sometimes I'm happy. But I'm subject to non-existence, because if I'm this body is going to turn into ashes one day. And so we have this samanya jnanam of the rope, this general knowledge of the rope. We have this general knowledge of the self. We know that I exist, and we know that I'm conscious. So too, we know that the snake looks like an S and is 2 feet long and has a rough texture. But we don't have any particular knowledge of it. We don't have the details. We don't actually have a true knowledge of the rope. We just have a general sense. If we take a torch, a flashlight, and we shine it on the rope, we see, there was never a snake there to begin with. There was nothing to be afraid of. It was just a rope. So to this pramana, this shastra, this shruti, this teaching, is that which shines the light on the nature of the self to give visheshajnanam, to give the specific knowledge of what the nature of the self is. And the nature of the self, the first step is this neti neti, like we talked about last week. Na iti na iti. I am not this body. This body is just one more thing in the world. I'm not this mind. These thoughts come and go. I'm the one constant presence amidst all these thoughts. So there's a superimposition, just like upon a rope is superimposed a snake. And then when you see the rope, the snake is laughable. You could still, if you turn off the flashlight, you still might see the snake there, but it causes no fear. It causes no more fear, because it's just a superimposition. It has nothing to do with the rope. The rope doesn't become the snake. The rope doesn't become slimy. The rope takes on no characteristics of a snake that's superimposed on it. Atma does not take on any of the characteristics of sadness or even happiness or mortality, because those are all superimposed on this unchanging existence, which is me. And this unchanging reality is what I surrender to in my knowledge at dawn when I sit and contemplate, when I do this meditation. Pratar namami. At dawn, namami, I surrender to in knowledge that which is tamasaf param, that which beyond darkness, transcends darkness. Because consciousness illumines ignorance and knowledge. I know what I don't know. Do you know Swahili? Nope. I know what I don't know. Consciousness doesn't care what, sunlight doesn't care what it lights up. It can light up the dirtiest of things or the most beautiful of things. It has no value judgment on what it illumines. Its nature is just to be brilliant, and therefore things are illumined. So too consciousness. Consciousness is beyond, it's beyond darkness. It's beyond darkness and light. It's beyond ignorance and knowledge. And therefore it is arkavarnam, of the color of the luminescence, the luminosity of the sun. And it's purnam, it's full, it's whole, it's complete. And what Pooja Swamiji uses as an example, you can imagine taking a pot, filling it with water until it's all the way to the brim, and then you keep dripping a little more, drop by drop by drop, until the surface tension of the water, you actually see it above the rim of the pot. And one more drop will cause the water to pour out. But just prior to that, that's purnatvam. So it literally means filled, it means fullness, it means completeness, it means a totality. It's that from which nothing is separate. It's purnatvam. Purnamidah, purnamidam, purnamidaha, purnamidam. This is fullness, that is fullness. It means it's the whole, it's the totality. There's nothing lacking, okay? And that's the nature of the self. So you can say it's infinite. That fullness means that there's a completeness, a wholeness, and infinitude. And it is sanatana padam. It is the beginningless, time-free reality, the limitless reality. Sanatana means timeless, but it means not limited vis-a-vis time, not limited regarding anything. And padam can mean abode, it can mean a state, but it really means the reality. It's the beginningless, time-free Brahman, the limitless abode of the jnani, the one who knows. And it is Purusha Uttama Akhyam. Purusha Uttama Akhyam. Its name, its Akhya, is Purusha Uttama. Purusha means a person. Literally means a man or a person. There's a couple of very beautiful derivations of Purusha. One is Purushaha Puri Shayanat, because he lies in the Pur, in the city of the body. The body is compared to a city. Another vigraha of Purusha is Puri Sharire tasmin shete iti purushaha. These derivations actually come from the Shankara Bhasha of the Taittiriya Upanishad. Purushaha puri shayana, because he lives in the body. Who lives in the body? Atma, I. So purusha can mean the I. Also, purushaha means Ishvara, because another derivation of the word purusha is purna bhuradayaha lokaha yena iti purushaha. Yena, by which bhuradayaha lokaha, all the worlds from bhu, etc., all the worlds are purna, are filled. By whom all these worlds are filled, meaning sustained, meaning have their cause in, that is purusha, and that is Ishvara. Because every world, every experience has its being in Ishvara, which is the cause of all beings. And so this purushaha is the highest, because there's nothing outside of it. It is purushottama akya. There's a beautiful Vedic hymn, Purusha Suktam. Sahasrashirsha purushaha sahasraksha sahasrapath. He has sahasrashirsha, he has 1,000 heads. Shiras means head. Sahasrashirsha purushaha sahasraksha sahasrapath. The one who has 1,000 eyes and 1,000 feet. What does that mean? It goes on, a beautiful description of Ishvara as the creator, as the cause of this entire creation. If you take it literally, if he has 1,000 heads and 1,000 eyes and 1,000 feet, that must mean he's a monopod cyclops, because he has one eye for every head and one foot for every head. He's bouncing around on one foot with one eye. No, it means that every eye is his. Sahasra means 1,000. It means limitless. Every head, every eye, every foot, every being is his. Everyone looking out through every mind, through every set of eyes, is really Bhagawan looking out. So he's called the Purusha. He is Ishvara. This Atma is Ishvara himself. Yasmin idan jagat ashesham ashesham murtau. Idam jagat, this world, ashesham. You see the words as two asheshams. Ashesham, ashesham murtau. The first ashesham, shesha means a remainder. Ashesha means without a remainder, complete. So idam, ashesham jagat, this entire world, yasmin, in which ashesha murtau, saptami, in this limitless form appears, pratibhasitam, in the next line. So that in whose limitless form this entire world appears, in whose limitless nature this entire world appears. We see a duality, and yet this entire duality is sustained and is born by this one Atma, this one existence. We see this world of plurality, of duality, is superimposed upon this non-dual self. In the Dakshinamurti Stotram, Vishwam, this entire world, Vishwam, Darpana Drishyamana Nagari Tulyam Nijantargatam. It's like a city, Nagari Tulyam, Tulyam, like a Nagari, like a city, Drishyamana, being seen, Darpane, in a mirror. Vishwam darpana drishyamana nagari tulyam nijantargatam. Actually, nija, in the self, atmani gatam. Actually existing, antargatam, existing within the self. So he's saying this entire creation, is this vishwam, this world, is like seeing the reflection of a city in a mirror. All of this phenomenon, all of this plurality, this nama rupa, this name and form, is as good as a city in a mirror. Anything that's seen in a mirror. What's the relationship of a reflection in a mirror with the mirror? Is the mirror affected when this, as though superimposition of this, all these colors and people and forms and names and activities, all this stuff is happening on the surface of the mirror? But the mirror is just merely reflecting it. This entire world is sustained. The mirror world, the world that is reflected in the mirror, is sustained by that mirror. If the mirror would go, the reflection would go. And yet the mirror sustains the entire mirror city, and yet it's completely unaffected. And in terms of reality, the mirrored city has very little reality. It's just color and movement and form. And so too, idam jagat ashesham, this entire world rests in existence, which is the truth of the self, which is the truth of me. Just like the city would rest in the mirror as its very basis. Ashesha murtav, in this murti, in this limitless nature, this entire world appears. There's only one thing here. Like when you look at a mirror, when you look, whatever you see held up in a mirror, whatever you see reflected in a mirror, what's there? The mirror. It's just that there's all this other stuff which is evanescent, ephemeral, which is as though exists on top of the mirror. The mirror lends its reality to it, but and really it's just name and form. There's nothing there. The only vastu is the mirror. The only one thing that's here is existence consciousness. And everything else is mitya. Everything else has a dependent reality. There's nothing here that's not time-bound. Everything has a prior and posterior non-existence. How do you say it truly exists? Everything here is decomposable, divisible. Boom. You can break it in half. You can break that in half. You can break that in half. You can break that in half. Everything here is subject to time and space and the limitations thereof. Except for Atma, except for consciousness. And this is what I surrender to in the morning. This is what I revel in. This is what I remember. Pratar smarami, I remember at dawn. Pratar pajami, I worship. I revel in this. Pratar namami, I surrender to this knowledge that I am this existent thing that is the one shining like the sun. And then when he gets to this punchline, he says, Rajjwam bhujangamaha eva, like a bhujangamaha, like a snake, Rajjwam on a rope, Rajju, 7-1, like a snake on the rope, pratibhasitam, superimposed, appearing, vai, indeed, vai means indeed. Indeed, this entire world, idam jagat ashesham, appears on this unchanging pure self, like a snake appears on the rope. Due to ignorance, we don't know the nature of the rope, and so it allows us to see the snake. If I knew the nature of the rope, I wouldn't see the snake. And if I did see the snake for some reason, it would be laughable. There would be no fear. The rope is unaffected, even by its superimposition. And it's, the snake is completely dependent upon the rope. And when the snake goes, nothing happens. What happens to the rope when the snake goes? Nothing. What happens to you when you wake up from a dream? When you dream, entire world is created. And when you wake up, boom, it's gone. Oh my goodness, what a holocaust. Everybody died. Everybody is, that was in the dream is no more. Oh my goodness. What happened when you wake up? What happened to all those dream bacteria, those billions of dream ants and birds and animals and cousins and nephews? What happened to them all? Nothing really. What happens to the individual who is dreaming? Nothing. It just goes. It's fine. It's like a snake. Just goes. Nothing happens to in reality. Nothing really happens. So this is the essence of this verse here. Pratar namami tamasav paramarka varnam purnam sanatana padam purushottamakyam yasmin idam jagadashesham ashesham murtau ratvam bhujangamaha eva pratibhasitam vai. Now there's one more verse here, and it's what's called a palashruti. It's an addendum. It's a metaverse. And you see this all over. You'll have a stotra, and then someone will come along and give another verse to explain just how wonderful these verses that we just heard are. So you can repeat twice after me. Shloka trayamidam punyam. Shloka trayamidam punyam, shloka trayamidam punyam, loka traya vibhushanam, loka traya vibhushanam, loka traya vibhushanam, pratah kale patetyastu, pratah kale patetyastu, pratah kale patetyastu. So this pratah, this prataha, which we saw earlier, turns to pratar namami, pratar bhajami. The word is actually pratar, at dawn in the morning. But we saw that in the first verse, it turns into pratasmara, pratasmarami, because of santi. And here, pratah kale, it's called a jihvamulya. You have a kha sound. So it's actually pratah kale. Pratah kale patetyastu. Pratah kale patetyastu. Sagacchet paramam padam. Sagacchet paramam padam. Sagacchet paramam padam. Altogether. Shloka trayamidam punyam. Loka traya vibhushanam. Pratah kale patetyastu. Sagacchet paramam padam. Shloka trayamidam. Patet. Yaha. The one who, yaha, patet, would recite idam, this shlokatrayam, this triad of verses, these three verses, shlokatrayam, punyam, which is sacred, which blesses one, which is punyam, this triad of verses is lokatraya vibhushanam, which is a jewel among the three worlds. You can look at the three worlds as being bhur, bhuvaha, suvaha, the three worlds, which is the physical world, the intermediate world, and the world of the heavens. Lokatraya vibhushanam. It's a palashruti. This is talking about the result you get. Pala means result. And so this is the result you get if you know the meaning, you chant, and you meditate on the meaning of this verse. This is what you'll get. This is the palam you'll get. Shlokatrayamidam punyam lokatraya vibhushanam pratah kale patet yaha. Yaha, the one, patet, who reads, who would recite pratah kale at dawn. Why at dawn? Why in the morning? We recite this in the morning because it jumpstarts our vision, our freedom for the day. It allows us time to ground our self-identity in what is real before we go out into the world and play the roles we need to play. We play the roles of a father or son or employer, employee, mother, daughter. We play all these roles, and it is a blessing to not be lost in them. So if we begin the morning with a remembrance, with a surrender to our knowledge of our true nature, we will be blessed by it. First thing we do in the morning is pratah kale patet, the one who would recite. Saha, he, gachet paramam padam, he gains the limitless abode. Paramam means without any limitation. Padam means abode or destination. It's an awkward translation because really what it means is that he gains by recognition his true self. And all samsara, samsara nivrittihi, he gains the removal of samsara by recognizing that he inherently, or she, is inherently free from samsara, because anything in samsara changes and moves, and consciousness is this one shining light which is ever free from that which it illumines and is the very adhishtana, the very basis. Yasmin idam jagat ashesham, that in which all of this world shines, on whose formless form all of this is superimposed. All of this appears. This entire world appears. And this entire world is really a manifestation of Ishwara's knowledge, of Maya Shakti. All of this variegated experience is just Maya Shakti manifesting, and that Maya Shakti is Ishwara's glory, and it's just his knowledge manifesting. And its nature is mithya. It is as real in some sense as though it were a snake upon a rope. Because from the perspective of the rope, there is no snake. From the perspective of Shuddha Chaitanya, which is Sat Chit Ananda, the world is just an apparent reality. And therefore I'm free and I'm fearless. And then I can go about my life doing what I need to do with compassion and understanding. Om Swasti Prajabhyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Go Brahmanebhyah Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yancho Barahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchit Dukkha Bhag Pavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityor Ma Amritangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vishishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om Om Tat Sat Sarvam Ishwararpanamastu.
Hari, it's such a short three verses. We are exposed to such a wonderful teaching. I mean, it's amazing how Shankara could think of it. It's amazing, really. In three verses, they're all encapsulated in three verses.
Right.
It's a marvel. Swamiji, I've been listening to this particular stotram for the last 3-4 days now, and I feel it keeps on coming back into my mind every throughout the day.
It's meant to stick with you.
Really. It's really a blessing. I think it's a blessing that we are all exposed to this.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful. Like I said, there's a number of Prata Smarana Stotras. They all tend to be focused on a given deity. There's one to Shiva, there's one to Ganesha, and those are beautiful. And then there's the Suprabhatams, like Venkateshwara Suprabhatam. But this cuts to the chase. Each word actually can be a complete meditation. So if you sit with even the English translation of one of the words and understand, each of those words or phrases can be taken as a meditation.
Swamiji.
Yes.
Well, I know how we, you know, you talk about consciousness, you know, being actionless, unmanifested, shapeless, formless. How do you explain or reconcile the idea that the nature of consciousness is to illumine?
So the nature of consciousness is not to illumine. The nature of consciousness is to shine. Mm-hmm. Because illumine implies that there's something to be illuminated and that somebody is doing the illumination.
Mm-hmm. Has a sense of action.
Yeah. So when you look at the sun, when you see the sun is lighting up the pot, that's analogous to saying that consciousness is lighting up the pot. I'm the one who is aware of the pot. But there's still this, what's called triputi. There's the knower, the known, and the knowing process. Even shining is an intransitive verb. When you illumine something, it's a transitive verb. There's a doer and an object of the action. Transitive verb means sakarmaka dhatu. It's a verb that takes an object. I see this. This is the thing I see. So I am the seer, and this is the object of my seeing. The sun is the illuminator, then it is illumining that which is illumined. And so we get to the point where we say, I am the one who is doing the action of being aware of all this anatma, of all this non-self, right, of the body. I'm the one who is aware of this. I am the sakshi of the sakshya. The sakshya are the things that I'm aware of. The sakshi is the one who's doing the witnessing. So I am witnessing this. So recognizing the sakshitvam, the state of being the sakshi of awareness, is crucial. But it's not the final step. It's not the last dance. It's not the final vision. It's just that we need to extricate consciousness from the unconscious, meaning the inert, from jada, from that which doesn't inherently enjoy consciousness. The body, mind, sense, complex do not inherently enjoy consciousness. It's borrowed. It's part of the superimposition. It's like the red-hot iron ball. The ball is inert. The ball is heavy and round. It just seems to be bright and hot because of the presence of fire. So too, the body seems to be sentient because of the presence of consciousness. And again, these are provisional statements, because we're not saying that in reality the awareness is awarer, is the sakshi, is the witness. But to understand, to help extricate consciousness from that which is unatma, the not-self, we go through this teaching methodology. Mm-hmm. And then we need to look at what the nature of that awarer is, of that witness. So is the sun really an illuminator, or is it just that it can't be but its true nature, and the sun's true nature is to just to shine? And it only provisionally takes on the role of being an illuminator is superimposed on the self-existent, self-manifesting sun, mm-hmm. because things are illumined, and therefore we posit the action of illuminating to the sun. So too with awareness, we posit the role of being the witness, because there seem to be things to be witnessed, but the nature of consciousness is not a witness. Its nature is just to shine. Mm-hmm. And so when we turn our attention towards the witness, it gets us closer to appreciation, just awareness.
So basically it's like just a mechanism that we use provisionally, because the limitations and constraints of human language. So it's just provisional language, because even the self is not a knower, because it only has itself.
There's nothing here but me.
Yeah.
So there's only one vastu. There's only one thing. And if you see that, then there's no problem. The domain of language is duality.
Yeah. Okay.
You can only say things that are spatial and temporal and have attributes. And the subject has no space, has no time, has no attributes. So how do you point that out?
Right. Okay.
Yeah. And so we point it out by saying, well, it's the one thing that never changes in our experience. It's the one thing that seems to be self-evident. Mm-hmm. It's the one changeless thing in every experience. Oh, okay. So we can get a sense of what that is. Because if you just say, you are everything, you are completeness, there's nothing else but you here, you can go, okay, now what, right? It doesn't solve any problem. You don't see it. So you need to start where people are. Where people are is that I'm this body. Okay, well, yeah. Then you do what's called Driktrisha Vivekaha, a teaching methodology which helps to differentiate the seer from the seen, to remove the anyonya adhyasa, the superimposition. You bring in avastatraya sakshi, like we did in Tathagata. We say, okay, well, now let's look at all of our experience. Our experience is subsumed by the waking state, the dreaming state, and the deep sleep state. Let's look at who I am in each of those. Do I go? Am I there? Ah, no, I don't go. I'm still there in all of those. And what's the reality of all this stuff? Then we look at satyam and mitya. We talk a lot about pots and clay, because we need to understand, well, if we have this anatma, if we have this not-self stuff, this anatma, is there a duality then? No, because the stuff which is anatma is mitya. The stuff which is not me has no independence from existence, which is me.
Okay, great. Thank you. That helps a lot.
Okay. It's not useful to dismiss the teaching methodology, which is premised on provisional statements, just because they're provisional, because most of our reality is those provisional statements. Mm-hmm. I take myself to be an individual walking down the street. Well, let's start there. That's a provisional statement. In truth, you're not an individual walking down the street, but we get to the truth unless we start with a fellow walking down the street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're like tools.
Exactly. The teaching methodology that's inherent in the sampradaya, in the lineage,